All right, good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for waiting and for joining us today. As you are aware, or not aware, hopefully you are aware, you have signed up to attend the Fulbright Scholar in Residence program focused on community colleges, and we're very happy to have you today. My name is Sarah Kauser. I work at IIE. I'm one outreach and recruitment analyst who oversees this program, and I'll let my colleague Kaylee introduce herself next.
Hi, everyone. My name is Kaylee Smasniak. I also work at IIE as a placement advisor for researchers and scholars.
And then we're also joined by David Levin, who is a senior program manager at the Bureau of Educational and Cultural Affairs. David, would you like to say hello?
Hi, everybody. Thank you for tuning in.
And last but certainly not least, we are thrilled to be joined by a former FIR host, Rich Johnson. Rich, would you like to introduce yourself?
Absolutely. Thank you. I'm very pleased to be here and can't sing the praises of this program enough, so thank you for having me.
Wonderful. Thanks so much, Rich. Before we kind of move on into the rest of this webinar, I just want to highlight a few things. There is a question box for you to chat in any questions throughout. We will have a special kind of ending where we will read those questions and try and get through as many as possible, so feel free to chat throughout. This webinar is also being recorded today, and within 2 to 3 business days, you can find it archived online. So without further ado, we will get started. We have in the past already done a general FIR overview, so we will try and cut down on that a little bit, leave more time for Rich to really talk about his experience and give you his insight into working with FIR. But what you will experience today is a brief introduction over what the Fulbright Scholar in Residence program is. Oftentimes you'll hear us say FIR throughout the duration of the presentation. We'll also include some programmatic insights from the State Department's perspective, which will also include trends within the program. And then we'll segue into a discussion of the FIR application components as well as available tools that you might find. And then we will follow it up with insight from Rich Johnson about his institution's experience with the FIR program. And last but not least, as I said, we'll have a section for questions and answers. So a brief overview of the Fulbright Scholar program. It was established in 1946, so we're currently in the 71st year, getting close to our 72nd. And it was established to send U.S. academics and professionals overseas, as well as bring those scholars and professionals from abroad to the U.S. It is sponsored by the U.S. Department of State, Bureau of Educational and Cultural Affairs, and it is administered through the Institute of International Education. This is a very prestigious program, and with a primary purpose when it was established, was a public diplomacy initiative within the Department of State. As you can see on the left-hand side is one of our earlier scholars when Burma finally opened up, and to the right of that is one of our more recent Arctic scholars. So we put these photos in here to really show the true breadth of the program. As a short overview, the Scholar in Residence program is a wonderful opportunity that allows you to bring scholars and faculty members from overseas to your campus. It is an institutionally driven program. So it would mean that you would get together with people across your institution to really develop a proposal to submit. This program will allow you to bring a visiting scholar to your campus, primarily to teach undergraduates, as well as providing cross-cultural international perspectives within the classroom. These scholar residents, what makes it very unique is they really impact the overall institution. They're seen on campus in different classrooms across different disciplines, things like that. These scholars can come from a variety of countries, whatever one you name, as well as they can be in any disciplines. It is predominantly humanity or social science based. However, if you do wish to bring a scholar outside those disciplines, we'd be more than happy to work with you. The overall deadline is October 15th, and if you have any questions, you'll see this email throughout the duration of this presentation. It's fir@iie.org. One special thing that we like to highlight is the fact that unlike other programs within the Fulbright umbrella, this program actually allows you to submit draft proposals to us no later than October 1st. We will actually review them and provide strategic feedback that will allow you to bolster and submit a more competitive application. So you won't get that kind of attention on any other program. I just want to highlight that. So that's something special we do like to offer. So on this next slide, we will be talking about the program benefits. I'm actually going to pass the mic over to David Levin to really give you his insights of what benefits the FIR can bring to your campus.
Sarah, thank you very much. This program is unique, I think, because it's one of the few FOPA programs that's actually institution-driven. So as Sarah said, it's really up to you as an institution to apply to host a scholar from abroad. It really is sort of win-win both for you and for the scholar. Because you're designing the proposal, you'll determine what will the scholar teach, what will the courses specifically be. And then beyond that, how would you engage the scholar across campus, perhaps guest lecturing in other departments, perhaps working with students in other ways. Maybe you've got an international club on campus. We've had scholars who've been part of the Faculty Senate to get a sense of how your school works. You know, think creatively about how you would utilize that scholar across the campus beyond specifically where they're teaching. And then beyond that, how would you engage a scholar within your local community? Maybe K-12 schools, maybe with the Rotary Club or other service organizations, maybe with the local media, maybe with a local museum. Again, think creatively about how you could utilize your scholar within the surrounding community. And the whole idea of this is internationalization, bringing the scholar to campus, having them engage in teaching and curriculum development, and then cross-cultural activities across campus really focuses on this whole notion of internationalization, and it's one of the few Fulbrights where the purpose is really for the benefit of the host institution. We hope the scholar will benefit from this, and we think they typically do. But this is not the usual Fulbright scholar grant where someone's coming to do research, for example, to complete their next textbook or do their lab research. It's really driven by what you as the U.S. institution would like.
Great. Thanks so much, David. So moving on, you might be wondering who is eligible. As we said before, this presentation is directed specifically at community colleges because they are a type of institution that we strongly encourage to apply. Other institutions this program is goals of serving include minority-serving institutions, which are all listed on the screen, small liberal arts, and rural colleges and universities. So we really wanted to have time to really set aside and focus on institutions like yours to really engage with you and promote this program. Going off of that, we just want to provide this slide to let you know just the history of the Scholar Residence Program from 2010 to really let you know the populations there. So as you can see, about 21% of the institutions that participated were community colleges. David, going off of this, the next slide we have is the list of community colleges that have hosted. Do you have any other insights into kind of trends you have?
So I would say that looking at the circle that you saw, or the donut, 21% with community colleges, I would say, in fact, on average, the number has actually gone up. I would say community colleges, in fact, are closer to 25 or 30%, which is terrific. And probably as good a percentage as you would see with any program, certainly that we would provide to the State Department and maybe even throughout the federal government. Community colleges do very well with this program. I think the whole notion of the program and the idea of developing a proposal, you know, as an institution, as a group on campus, and working together to determine what your scholar will do really sort of fits the whole notion of a community college and the kinds of things that you do together.
Great. Thanks so much, David. And just to give another visual about community colleges, and as we said, we have been seeing this trend on an uptick. We just wanted to show you community colleges by year, just to let you know the true nature of how many are involved. And our goal is to really, you know, double these numbers, triple as many as we can. We would like to see as many community colleges participating in this program. So with that kind of ends the overview of the Scholar in Residence program. I'm actually going to pass the microphone to Kaylee, who will talk about the actual application and those components.
Thanks, Sarah. So the application itself is housed online, everything online through a system called Embark. And since we really do want to focus today's session around hearing from Richard and that community college perspective, I will run a little more quickly through these sections. But a quick note on webinars, if you do want a more in-depth look at the application components, take a look at the webinar we held a few weeks ago. And then we'll also, and it'll be posted on our website. And then we'll also have application-facing webinars in May, and then in early fall to answer any lingering questions before that October 15 deadline or October 1 draft deadline. So you'll see upon starting an application that there's a shorter application form in which you enter text or use drop-down, followed by a section in which it asks you to upload a number of documents. One tip is that it's always helpful for institutions to start the application early and to really gain insight into what's asked of them and get a sense of the components. Just to actually physically click through the application is so helpful. I'd also encourage you to take a look at our Scholar in Residence guidelines on our website to get a closer look at the different components that the application form and later the narrative proposal entail. So for this first section of the application, you'll see on the screen the individual components. It's a more basic section. You'll be mostly writing names and contact information in the text boxes, but I do want to highlight a few pieces. So there's two contacts listed here. One is the administrative official or anyone who can sign off on affiliation information. I know that this really varies for between colleges and community colleges and everything. Then the other is the principal contact for academic arrangements. So for both of these, we defer to your individual institution as to who the appropriate individual is. And then for program dates, we are working pretty far in advance, so you'd actually be listing dates for the 2019-2020 academic year. For financial support, and then the named versus recruited scholars, we'll be looking at that in more in depth in a moment, but you would list basic information in this application form section. And then lastly, there's a proposal summary. That one has a limit of 700 characters. It's a required field, and it really gives our reviewers a snapshot of what your program and your proposal entails. So it's very helpful if you use this section to highlight all of your major proposal pieces. Okay, so now we're getting into the next section called the narrative, which is really the essence of the application, and it's divided into two parts. First, we have the institutional profile, which is on the screen now. It's 4 to 5 pages, or 7 to 8 if you're looking at a joint proposal. Keep in mind that the reviewers may or may not know your institution, so this section is really key to giving them a better idea of what you're all about. So things you will include in this institution profile include just general information. We find it's often helpful to just break down the pages, those 4 to 5 pages by section, so slot a few paragraphs under the mission heading, and then the academic offerings heading, and then on down the line. What we mainly want to see is how your institution is set up and what you have in place, and alternately what you don't have in place on campus that a scholar in residence could potentially help with or complement or fill in a gap. And then this section is also where you indicate your institution's short and long-term goals and objectives. So what are you hoping to gain through internationalizing your campus and efforts? And then how specifically would hosting a scholar in residence assistance fit into these short and long-term goals? And then, David, I wanted to hand it over to you and see if you wanted to discuss any pieces with us.
Thank you. Now, this is the chance for you to talk about your institution and talk about the kinds of things you're doing internationally. And what would you like to add on with the benefit of a scholar in residence? So it could be that you don't have a lot going on. You'd like to start something, and that's great. It also could be that you may have a fair amount going on, and that's okay, too. And you might then want to say, we'd like to bring a scholar in that would let us take our next step or do something a bit different than what we're doing. So it's not simply for an institution that has not done a lot. It could be for an institution that's done a fair bit, but in fact would like to expand what they've got. You've got a program in a certain country. You'd like to bring a scholar in, for example, to work in another country to take you to a next step or next level. So think about this in terms of how does a scholar fit into both your short-term internationalization efforts, but how do you see the scholar perhaps benefiting you in 5 or 10 years down the road?
Thanks, David. Okay, so the second part of this narrative proposal, which is also an upload, is where you show what the Scholar-in-Residence program is going to accomplish for you. So, Rich, after I run through a few pieces here, I'm going to hand this over to you to discuss this section a little bit from your perspective, but first I'll just run through these components quickly. So within the oversight section, you are addressing who on campus will be responsible and for what during the entirety of the scholar's visit. So you'd already have two faculty identified in the first part of the application, so that administrative official and the faculty associate that I had mentioned. So this provides a nice background of those individuals and what they will be doing for the scholar-in-residence on campus. So we've seen this oversight section take various forms. There could be a few faculty or staff listed here, or there could even be a whole Fulbright steering committee that engages staff from different departments or backgrounds. So this, again, is really all dependent on your specific college. We just want to see what thought has been put into the potential scholars program on campus and that they and the college will be set up for success. For academic program of the scholar, so here you would talk about what qualifications or background a scholar should have to meet the proposal's needs. We often get questions about how many courses a scholar might teach on campus, so we see about on average 2 per semester. Sometimes that scholar might be teaching an already designed course and just bringing an international perspective to it, or they might even be creating an entirely new course that's not yet in the course catalog. So just explaining this in this section is helpful for the reviewers to understand how much preparation is going to need to go into completing these activities. Then be sure to discuss how the FIR will interact all across campus and even across the community. This should show that you've really thought through how to maximize the scholar's time and presence in your whole community. For professional enrichment, so David mentioned that this is institutionally driven application, and it's about what works and what will help to enhance the institution's program. But we also want to see where there's potential for the scholar's individual growth. So if you plan to include a scholar in faculty meetings or attending academic conferences and asking them to join, you'd indicate that here. For sustainability, so focus on how you'd sustain the scholars' activities after they leave. David did mention a few of these at the beginning, but did you want to run through sustainability?
Sure. So we think about how you might have the scholar benefit your campus after they leave, whether that's maybe setting up a student exchange or faculty exchange with the scholar's home institution, maybe it's teaching a class online. Think creatively about how might you use, take the scholar's benefit from them having them on campus and continuing that kind of activity with them, with their home institution, whenever they've left you on campus after they go home.
Okay, thank you. Okay, and then financial support. So you will take the amounts that you had entered in the application form, that first section I had mentioned, and then you'll expand on what cost share you might be able to provide, be it in-kind support or a supplement of some sort. So cost share is encouraged, and institutions are asked to really think creatively about ways they can provide this, but it is not required by any means. You won't be disqualified if you cannot provide financial support. So we've seen institutions offer meal plans on campus, provide or defray the cost of housing, provide public transportation, audit classes. So just taking any piece that you can offer to this potential scholar and then provide estimates about what those are valued at, that's what you'd be putting in this section. And then, David, again, if you want to expand on any of the financial support pieces.
Right, so as Kaylee said, it's not a requirement. If I'm looking at sort of the high and the lows, we've seen everything in terms of a cost share salary supplement from zero to $50,000. And it's really dependent on what you as an institution have to offer. And we realize that these days this may be more of a challenge than it's been otherwise. We understand that. So we really look at this case by case. If you're able to offer a salary supplement, great. If not, are there other kinds of things you could do in terms of in-kind, the kinds of things that Kelly was talking about?
Great, thanks. And then, Rich, I did want to hand it over to you. If you could just talk a little bit about what it was like to fill out the application and what you went through in the process internally before hitting submit.
Absolutely. Thank you again for asking me to talk about this. I think that in terms of the application, it seemed a bit daunting at first. It was a bit scary to take it on, but really when you break it down into these individual parts, proposal part one, proposal part two, and you have a strong support network within your institution, each of these makes logical sense and builds upon the previous one. So when you're looking at oversight, make sure that you have a strong steering committee, a group of people who can offer assistance in a variety of different areas. Think about how the academic program of the scholar will integrate essentially and fully into the life of the college, not only the teaching but also tutoring centers, student advising, all of those sorts of things where that person can fit in and become an essential aspect of the fabric of the college. The qualifications and experience, depending on whether you have a named or unnamed scholar, look to the scholar's qualifications and experiences to see how they might integrate into the campus. Outreach is also key. Thinking of K-12 institutions within your immediate area, a variety of different organizations such as those that David mentioned, Rotary, Lions Club, even Boy Scouts of America, other institutions that might be in the area. Each of these elements makes for a more integrated and complete application and is crucial to, I think, a successful application. I'll talk a little bit about this later. Professional enrichment is key. This isn't just a one-way street. How does the scholar benefit from being at your institution? You have a lot of things to offer, whether it's a unique shared governance system or a unique student advising system or how you approach professional development. All of these things may be new, exciting, intriguing to the scholar. And then the last three elements, sustainability, financial support, and duration are also key. Sustainability, I always think about sustainability in terms of long-term contacts with either the institution the scholar's from or the scholar himself. We are still in very close contact with a scholar whom we hosted in 2015, and I'll talk a little bit about him later. The financial support, that's always a scary one because you think, gosh, if I don't offer enough, we'll be turned down. Or if we offer too much, then, the administration may resist being part of this. So don't be afraid to be truthful about your financial capacity and also think creatively about your in-kind contributions that enhance the scholar's experience. So that's just a quick rundown of the things I would think on this page.
Rich, thank you so much. I think that you spoke perfectly to how all pieces of this application just serve to strengthen your main goal and
yes.
What you'll do with that scholar. Yeah, thank you so much. Okay, so that said, let's get to the actual scholar itself. So after the narrative portion, we'll then want to hear more about the scholar that you wish to bring. So this allows for two different tracks, either naming a scholar or asking for recruitment of a scholar. So for naming, you can name the scholar in your proposal that perhaps a faculty member has worked with in the past. So if you name, then please outline why that particular scholar best fits your particular proposal. We ask that you submit a CV and two letters of recommendation. One of the letters should speak to the scholar's teaching ability, since they are coming to your campus to primarily undertake teaching. You'll also want to ensure that they have the required English language skills to teach that topic on campus. If you don't have a specific scholar in mind or have those connections in place, then that's no problem. You can request recruitment of a scholar. So on the application, you'll be able to choose two different countries within one world region. These are listed on our website, so if you see that and you don't see a country that you're interested in, just reach out to us at that FIR email inbox that Sarah had mentioned, and we'll definitely be able to discuss with you. So in the proposal, you will include information about the type of the scholar that you would like for us to recruit. We then use these details to reach out to our colleagues abroad to see if they're able to recruit within a certain discipline or specialization that you're requesting. So we ask that you outline the credentials of the scholar and if there's a certain amount of teaching experience needed for the subject that you're requiring, if anything helps us to narrow down recruitment efforts. We often get questions regarding if your chances are better to name versus recruit a scholar, so I will ask David to provide a little bit of insight, and then maybe Rich, unless you'll be talking about this later. So first, David.
Sure. There's no specificity in terms of one or the other. Either is perfectly fine. I would say we probably, if I look at this historically, in recent years, we probably are getting more named scholars than recruited scholars. But that, you know, as I said, it doesn't matter. If you request a scholar by name, that's fine. If not, our Fulbright commissions and U.S. embassies abroad are perfectly happy to recruit for you.
Mm-hmm. And then, Rich, would you mind talking at all about which path you chose?
Absolutely. And I mean, take David absolutely at his word. I was afraid that recruiting a scholar was a recipe for being turned down, that we didn't know what we were doing, we had no context, we had nothing going for us, and that's the furthest from the truth. Not only does the IIE, but also the Fulbright commissions in country, I mean, there are all kinds of mechanisms to choose very appropriate scholars for your needs. But also, don't be afraid of requesting a particular scholar. If you have a scholar in mind, that also enhances your application, I think, to some extent. We had a very specific goal and a very specific person in mind for our last one, the one I'm going to talk about at the end. And there are a few extra hoops to jump through. You have to make sure that he or she can get release time from their institution. There's a number of sort of logistical aspects to it. But both of these paths, specific scholar, recruiting a scholar, are equally beneficial, and you should do whatever makes the most sense in your particular instance.
Perfect. Thanks to you both. And as we've been saying, it really does depend on your individual institution and your needs. So we're happy to work with you in whichever path. Then next up, we have supplemental materials. This is the last portion of the application that we'll be talking about. So the letters of support section, these would directly relate to your institution and what you're applying to do. So at a minimum, the supplemental materials should include a letter from your administrative official saying, yes, this person is welcome on campus. They'll be provided with this. There's no maximum to the number of letters that you can supply. So you could seek out letters from different departments across your college and even across neighboring institutions. If you're arranging community outreach and activities, then also include those with the Rotary Club or any other clubs or institutions or bodies in the area. So if you are including these letters in your application, this is not setting it in stone by any means. It's just showing that there are people excited and ready to have this FIR on campus and prepared to incorporate them into their own activities. And then there can be more added later, so you're not tied to the letters that you supply here. And then lastly, the sample syllabi and the course outline. So we'd like to see what the course entails to get a sense of what it's about. If you're naming a specific scholar, you might already have insight into what they'll be able to teach and craft that syllabus in a way that enhances the need to have that particular scholar on campus and uses their cultural perspective. So again, it's just really about where there is a need at your institution and all of these pieces working together to create one strong application. Then so once you move forward with your application, you might be curious what the external review committee is looking for during the review. So as we have said many times now, just really make sure that all of these pieces are working together and give the reviewers a picture of what you're hoping to accomplish through this proposal and working with an SIR. So you'd actually write what your short-term goals are and your long-term goals are, show that sustainability, and how will hosting an SIR contribute to these goals. So we really did already discuss most of these when running through the application components, so just to hone in on a few pieces here, you'll want to think through if the proposal is feasible within the time period. And you'll also want to be expanding as much as possible on the types of community outreach and engagement, along with creating a network across your own college. Again, when we hear from Richard in a moment, I think we'll be able to see some of these pieces in action, but I hope that this has been helpful just to see a breakdown of the application itself first.
All right, I promise we're about to get to Rich. We just want to drive home one last point about this application process. As you are aware, the application deadline is October 15th, and as I mentioned before, we do allow for an October 1 deadline for proposals for those drafts. Of course, we always encourage you to submit them earlier, so we are not inundated at the very end. We want to give you guys as much feedback as we can, so if you can submit it earlier, great. If you have to wait till October 1st, that's fine too. But really, please utilize this benefit. It is there to help you. It's hopefully to deter you from being afraid to submit and know that, hey, I actually have a shot in this program. But as you can see, this timeline is on our website. After that application deadline of October 15th passes, the applications will go through program staff where we will conduct technical reviews just to ensure everything is complete and nothing is missing. At this point, we're not trying to weed you out. We will follow up if something is missing just to ensure that we get those materials from you. So this should definitely not deter you from applying. In December, the applications will go to an external review committee. They will meet, they will decide, you know, which applications will be funded for that following year. Then those applications, you as the institutions will be notified in January of that outcome. Between January and February, the applications will go overseas for the additional review, as well as at that same time, IIE will be confirming institutional funding. From anywhere from January to April, dealing with those foreign posting commissions overseas, we will confirm the scholars if you have named them, or we will begin recruiting those scholars from abroad. And so those will actually be done in country. They will then get kind of a listing of people that they think might meet the criteria that you have set forth, and then you ultimately get to decide from there which one you would like if you are requesting a recruitment of the scholar. And then from April to June, we will be sending the grant packets to the grantees, and then they should be arriving on your campus anytime from that summer on. I did live with one more slide. Kaylee was talking about a lot of resources earlier. This presentation will be online, so you can actually click these links, but on anywhere on our SIR program page, you can actually find, you know, access to the application, which is through Embark. It's new, it's great, it's user-friendly in my mind, my opinion, I should say, as well as some great application guidelines that can help you walk through, you know, the pieces that you need to submit. So they're very thorough, so please take a look at that. We also have institutional and scholar stories online, but instead of talking about those online, we have Rich here to talk about his institution's experience. So, Rich, I would be more than happy to pass over the mic to you.
All right. Well, Well, thank you very much. I'm going to start off talking a little bit about our approach to internationalization, if you'll just bear with me. The sort of operational, we have three legs, three paths, if you will, integrated tracks in our internationalization efforts. And our goal in all three is to be intentional, accessible, and sustainable over the course of all of our efforts. So we have one of the approaches or one of the tracks is strategic planning, which is working in coordination with a variety of stakeholders on campus. Obviously, international mobility, students coming in, students going out, faculty exchanges, faculty in and out. And then really the operational linchpin of our internationalization effort is the slide that you see before you, the global region of focus. Our global region of focus is a three-year cycle of programs and area studies that focus on a particular region of the world. And they guide basically everything that we do during the course of that three-year period. Each year, however, has a particular set of goals and a theme. Year one, as you see, is building capacity among our faculty. I've always said if you do not have a globalized faculty, it's virtually impossible to get a globalized student body. So you have to build capacity among faculty. And we do that with what we call the Faculty International Field Seminar. That is comprised of 15 hours of professional development coursework taught by a regional expert, someone who is expert in that area, followed then during the summer by a 16-day travel program to the region of the world in order for faculty to make institutional contacts and begin to build curriculum infusion projects. The second year, we try to build in a visiting faculty residency, and this is where the Fulbright SIR program has been absolutely crucial and essential and foundational to our efforts. And we're also thinking of trying to create partnerships with institutions overseas in the event that we don't get an SIR 1 year, or not to simply depend on one means of achieving the residency. Years two and three, we focus on study abroad experiences to the region for students, so increasing student mobility to the area. Our first region of focus, we began this process in 2014. Our first region of focus was East Africa from 2014 to 2017. And we took 9 faculty to Uganda and Rwanda, where we spent 2 weeks visiting 4 different campuses of the national universities, 2 in Uganda and 2 in Rwanda. The 9 faculty themselves were from 7 different disciplinary areas, and over the course of the 3 years, those 9 faculty infused 101 sections of 34 discrete classes, having a direct impact on 2,400 plus students. So the immediate impact is evident. Not only is that simply a sort of astounding statistic in one way, but it's also the sort of information that administrators and other stakeholders, whether it's in your foundation, board of trustees, board of directors, presidents, like to see, like to hear. What's the impact? These faculty also created 4 different study abroad programs to East Africa, which in and of itself is quite a feat. 14 students participated in a service program to Zimbabwe, 10 students to Uganda, 8 students to Rwanda, and then we had a very small group of 6 students who ended up going to Kenya as well. Those 3 years also produced different national conference presentations and a variety of other workshops and lectures. So for the final sort of count was 75 programs impacting 3,200 students. Our next region is Latin America, and last summer we took 16 faculty from 14 different disciplines, both transfer and career programs, to Guatemala, El Salvador, and Nicaragua. Each faculty participant created a curriculum infusion project along with an assessment plan to determine whether their goals had been, their learning goals, objectives had been met. In the fall, 20 courses were infused, and in the spring, this semester, 15 globally infused courses were announced. And we expect 4 new faculty-led study abroad proposals to the region in the next 2 years. So it's a very integral part of our approach. Now, the next slide, if someone could advance it, thank you, speaks directly to our experience with Fulbright. So from 1999 to 2007, we've had the good fortune of co-hosting 5 Fulbright scholars. 4 were SIRs, and they were joint proposals with a local sister community college. And 1 was a 6-week direct access to the Muslim World Visiting Specialist Scholar. But really, our rock star experience was with the gentleman whom you see on the slide, Professor Jim Rex Mamugusha from Makerere University. And he spent the fall semester of 2015 with us. And you see just a quick rundown of the various dimensions that we referred to earlier in the presentation of his experience. So he gave 22 different campus lectures. He did not teach a specific course, I should mention. Given his area of expertise and our departmental diplomacy, he was used more in terms of guest lectures and things like that, but gave 22 lectures impacting over 600 students. He also had did other programs such as running a faculty book discussion group, curriculum infusion workshops. He attended campus meetings of shared governance groups. He participated in a fall diversity symposium. He was also a guest and appointed member of the International Studies and Programs Committee. He worked with a study abroad risk management group. So he had a variety of different essential roles to play on campus. In terms of his professional outreach, he participated in 12 programs in 6 different states, visiting 7 colleges, 1 university, 1 high school, elementary schools, religious communities, city authorities, community groups. And we even attended together a 3-day statistical methodology conference, which I found to be completely eye-shutting, but he found illuminating. Personal enrichment, he experienced a lot of travel in the United States, went to visit Ugandan colleagues in San Diego, in Lawrence, Kansas. We went to D.C. for the conference. He went to Moline, Iowa, where he visited the John Deere Pavilion. He also attended a Renaissance Fair, which was quite eye-opening for him. I took him to a minor league baseball game, and he also found a faith community here at a local community church as well. And so his entire experience was really quite wonderful. I think I can say that on his behalf. We continue to be in touch. Due to our experience with him, he also spent a lot of personal time with a number of the members of the steering committee and people whom he had met when we were in Uganda. On the next slide, ongoing impact, obviously we have a variety of study abroad programs that we have built and are ongoing to that area, to East Africa. We are sharing teaching materials with colleagues whom we met through GymRex, and it's been very beneficial in that way. Sorry, next slide. Lessons learned in terms of the application process. David and Kaylee and Sarah, as we've all sort of reiterated, it's not an overnight process. It really is about a 12 to 18 month process to put together a fully intentional, strategic, and comprehensive application. One of the key underpinnings is a strong steering committee that represents a variety of different stakeholders and constituencies on campus, and can also serve as the people to whom you can turn when you need something done very quickly. So it's got to be people who are willing to work as well, but people who have a variety of roles to play on campus. As was mentioned earlier, there are a variety of different in-kind contributions. We found, given as a community college, we are essentially a commuter college and a meal plan. We did not have one for Professor Byamugisha, but I would strongly urge thinking about a meal plan as an in-kind contribution. The scholar spends a good deal of time on campus, and that can be crucial. In Illinois, community colleges are not supposed to have on-campus residential housing, and so housing was an issue for us as well. I think that's something that you need to think about as a committee. How is that going to work? Transportation as well, making sure that the housing is relatively close or at least on a public transportation line is key. Making connections with research universities in the specific disciplinary area of the scholar is important for his or her own professional development. Something that we realized a bit too late for Professor Byamugisha is it would be great to host a conference around that scholar's area of specialty and perhaps have feature him or her as the keynote. That would be a really great thing. Also, you should definitely take advantage of the occasional lecture fund, which is going to come up in a minute too. And so I'm not going to say a whole lot about that, but that is a key element of our approach as well. And then the last slide talks about inspiration, how this immediate experience with Professor Byamugisha has inspired us in our efforts, increased awareness on campus. It completely energized our faculty, increased attendance at our programs. Professor Byamugisha was noted in a variety of news outlets and really sort of brought national and regional attention to our internationalization initiative. So it was a marvelous experience. But directly, it's inspired us to work on other grant opportunities. We're thinking about putting together a Fulbright Hayes abroad project, working as a junior partner with University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign as a junior partner on a Title VI grant that they're thinking of, and a variety of other initiatives. It's really sparked our desire to do that. We've created more study abroad opportunities tied to the region of focus. Worked also on service learning component. One of Professor Byamugisha's areas of interest was service, and when we took a group of students to Uganda, we included a service component, and that's become an element of our approach on campus as well, including service and study abroad. And then promoting online collaborative learning experiences, given that travel to East Africa can be expensive and often difficult, we have begun to initiate these sorts of partnerships with Makerere University in particular and Professor Byamugisha's immediate department. Statistics. And it's just created, energized and incentivized our faculty to be more globally aware and participate more meaningfully, directly, and enthusiastically in our internationalization efforts. So I know I've rattled on for a long time. I apologize. But the Fulbright SIR process experience is wonderful. The people you work with through IIE are great. David is amazing. And I can't, again, as I said at the outset, I can't sing the praises of this particular program loudly or out of key or loudly enough. So thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Rich. To everyone in the audience, we definitely want to say we don't expect you to become rich overnight. Rich has, do keep in mind, he has been doing this for a number of years and has really been involved in the program. But, again, this is open for you as well. We want to highlight that while, you know, in the past, you know, It can take numerous months. We want to also say it can be done in a shorter time frame, and the more you do it, the easier it will become. So don't let that 12 to 18 months deferral.
Sorry.
No worries, Rich. We just want to make sure everyone is aware it can be done. Obviously, you know, the more time you can devote to it, the stronger an application you will have. But definitely don't let that deter you. But again, thank you so much, Rich, for that insight. And I want to remind, we have a couple more slides, or actually I think it's just one, but I just want to remind our attendees, please feel free to submit questions either to us on the IAE staff, David at the Department of State, or Rich, and we'll get to those in a moment. All right. So as Rich so kindly alluded to OLF, which may be very proud, we want to highlight just one other program that you can utilize in the meantime. So as you are aware, there are scholar in residence in the country. There are actually 900 Fulbright visiting scholars at any given point. Some of those are those SIRs. All of these scholars can be requested by your institution to come to your campus for short-term lectureships of 2 to 6 days. It might help you, you know, get your feet wet in, you know, hosting and seeing what goes into an application. This is definitely a shorter application. You pretty much just say who you wish. There's a scholar directory on our website. You can look by discipline, country, so on and so forth. But you would basically just put together an application saying who you wish to apply, what are the dates, what are the lecture topics. You can also share with other nearby institutions as well. And once you are approved to have an SIR, please do not forget this program and the value that the SIR would be on your campus as well as other campuses. So I just wanted to put that out there. The application deadline, it is rolling. We just ask that you apply at least a month ahead of time. And we do have scholars throughout the duration of the summer. So if you can't find someone online, just reach out to me, actually, at olf@iie.org, and I'd be more than happy to work with you to see if we can find someone either in these kind of closing semester months or throughout the summer. And with that, we are now at the question and answer portion of this presentation. So please submit questions. You can direct them, as I said, to a certain person, or we will all discuss it, but I just want to reiterate a few things that our website is on the screen, as well as our email address, and we are on all types of social media, so please engage with us online. But with that, we will transition over to the questions. The first one that we have is actually from an institution who runs a digital media production program, and they're interested in inviting a filmmaker or film scholar, and if that is possible through SIR. Kaylee?
Yeah, so that is definitely an option. Sarah had mentioned that we primarily see social sciences and humanities go through, but that's certainly not to say that there haven't been SIRs from other disciplines, so we would say to that you'll just really need to think through all of these application components because they would be primarily teaching or lecturing in some way, shape, or form. So making sure that they have the experience and the tools necessary to do that. If you're naming a scholar, if you're recruiting, then just laying out all of the pieces that you'd need in a potential scholar in order to accomplish those goals. But David, do you want to talk about that from a policy standpoint?
Sure. So as Kaylee said, it's virtually any subject you can imagine or discipline. But the point would be you need to demonstrate whatever scholar you're naming or requesting, how is the scholar bringing to your campus enhanced comparative or international perspective to whatever they're teaching and whatever other kinds of things they're doing. So, you know, think creatively about that. It is open to any field. We've had people, in fact, what we thought initially feel it might be tough to demonstrate comparative international perspective would be someone teaching art sciences, for example. We have, in fact, have examples of people who've done that. They've demonstrated how teaching geology, for example, coming from a country abroad, in fact, internationalized that coursework.
Wonderful. Another question we have is from a community college, which is wonderful because that's where you should be, is in regards to teaching loads. At community colleges, they tend to be higher than at four-year institutions. Can institutions proposed with a visiting scholar teach more than 2 courses per semester? David, do you have any insight on that?
Sure. You could, although you should bear in mind that the scholar is coming from abroad, perhaps not familiar with your curriculum and the way things are done on your campus. Aside from the fact that it's a different country, different culture, obviously. So you might think about, if you're thinking 3 classes, for example, bringing a scholar in for an academic year, you might think about 3 classes perhaps in the second semester, but perhaps the first semester you go with the 2 or even with 1, again, because it's a bit challenging for them, again, to become acculturated, and that can be a little bit stressful at times. So think about that as you think about the kinds of, or the level of classes, the number of classes that you're thinking of assigning to your SIR.
And could we also have Rich speak to that? I know that you work things a little bit differently because of the fact.
Yeah. I think one of the things that ought to be remembered as well is that it is a two-way street. And so the scholars they're not coming over necessarily to teach a full load or those sorts of things, but also cultivate their own professional development. And so while teaching is great and does enhance professional development, it also seems to me that you want to be mindful of their own perhaps research interests, academic contacts, and disciplinary specialties, and those sorts of things. And as David suggested, think creatively about other means, other ways in which you might increase their contact with students if teaching load is part of the issue, whether it is being in a tutoring center or those sorts of things. So there are a variety of ways to think about it creatively.
Wonderful. We also have an additional follow-up question. I believe this is better for you, Rich. In terms of when you found out that you were being awarded an SIR, did you, given that timeline, feel you had enough time to really get that award in that kind of catalog of course offerings to get students to register, or did you feel it was kind of a tight turnaround? How did you deal with that?
That's an excellent question. In our case, because we had known, we had a recruited, I'm sorry, we knew the name of the scholar, we knew his area of specialty, we had sort of put together a plan that we were able to institute on a fairly quick turnaround. We had a class, we had a section, and had we not gotten it, we would have had an adjunct teach that particular section. So we were able to do it fairly easily. However, I understand that can be fairly difficult.
Great. Thanks so much, Rich. Mm-hmm. The last question we have, and again, if you do submit after this presentation is over, feel free to email or call us. We'd be more than happy to help. But the last question we have, I'm actually going to direct towards David, and that's in regards to, say, an institution request a certain scholar and it turns out that scholar is not eligible, would that actually have a detrimental effect on the application?
No, if you actually name a scholar, we would then go, and it turns out for some reason that scholar is not eligible, we would then work with you to see if you had another named scholar, or we could also, absent that, we could recruit for you from 1 or 2 countries in the same region. So that's not a non-starter. The one thing I would say is, depending on when we found out that scholar was not eligible or that scholar had to drop out for whatever reason, we hope there'd be enough time to recruit for you or get another scholar in place, again, for the time that you're talking about, for the following September, let's say. That's not always possible. What we strive to do that, even if the scholar that we look for is not available.
Right.
Okay, so I think that we are about to wrap up, but before we do, just as Sarah said, use our contact information on the website. If you call that number, you'll reach me. and then I just wanted to see if there's any final thoughts from either David or Rich before we wrap up.
This is David. Let me say one other thing. I always get a question about, when I talk about this program, people say to me, what would my odds be? Is this a typical federal program where, you know, you've got a 1 in 10 shot, and is it worth my while? Last year we had 40 applications and we funded 32 grants. So I don't know of a program where your odds are in fact better. We'd like to see our application numbers go higher than that. We'd like to see 60 applications. But if we're funding ultimately 35 proposals or even 40 proposals out of 60 or 70, you're still talking about odds that are better than 2-1, which I think are great odds for any program.
Agreed. Thank you, David. And anything from your end, Rich?
No, I would just let anyone know they can reach out to me. My email is rjohnson@harpercollege.edu, and I think that this is a really unique and powerful way for community colleges to internationalize their campus.
Great. Thank you so much, Rich. And for all those who are listening, we'll also provide that email when the recording is complete and we send that out. We'll provide, with Rich's permission, that email for you. Thanks, Rich. That email for you to contact, just in case you have kind of questions on how to really navigate through the application process. Again, we're here to, if you have any kind of thoughts you want to pitch, we're here to help you, you know, submit a very competitive application. That is our role. We do also, as we said earlier, have other webinars coming up. This one was dedicated just for community colleges. There is a more general one that really dives a little deeper into the application components, as well as we do have some coming up that will be the application walkthrough. And Kaylee, what was the second one?
Yeah, so in early fall, closer to the deadline, will be it will almost act as office hours. So if you don't catch us on the phone or in an email and you just want to sit in and hear what other questions other applicants might have, then that might be a good venue for you to do that.
Well, again, thank you so much for spending time with us today to go over this really wonderful program. If you have questions, please reach out, but we will give your afternoon back. Thank you for coming.
All right. Thank you all very much.
And thank you so much, Rich and David, for being here.
I hope that was helpful.